Okay, so I'll first talk about droplet dynamics and then move on to something else with vortices and then come back and combine the two things. So we all know that whenever there's droplets or particles in turbulence, these particles move away from high vorticity and they agglomerate in regions which are of high strain. So this is a dogma which is for the most part true, and we will not discuss exceptions to this rule today. So you can see that these blue and red things are regions of high vorticity, and the particles have left these regions and they are agglomerating in regions of high strain. So this is the thing that we are going to explore in greater detail and see how we can exploit it for our
lives. Doesn't it depend on the particle size, if the particle is a bubble, I guess?
Yeah. Sorry. Thanks for saying that. These are heavy particles. They're way, way heavier than the fluid. And so if they're bubbles, they will do the exact opposite. They will agglomerate in regions of high vorticity. And depending on the size of the particle, there'll be a time constant which determines how fast they leave the region of high vorticity.
Thank you.
So this is basically the thing. So the first point I want to make is the following. We want to look at the vicinity of exactly one vortex and see what's going on there. And we will first discuss how, we're showing how these two regions next to one vortex where the particle dynamics is entirely different. Okay? And that's what it is. So I've colored the first one green and the second one red. It's green but it looks yellow. So here is the vortex core. It's a Gaussian vortex. There's a special radius here which we will come to, inside which we've colored all the particles green, outside which all the particles are red. And the claim is that just leave these particles next to a vortex and the way the green particles behave is going to be very different from the way the red particles behave. And the basic summary is that the green particles will do ballistic motion. They leave the region of the vorticity very fast. The red particles won't do too much. They will centrifuge out very slowly from the region of the vortex. And that is what is seen in this movie. Is it green? Yeah. So you'll see that this region is getting cleaned out very fast. So effectively the green particles will clean out very fast. The red particles will slowly agglomerate and nothing else will happen. So this is the first point I want to make.
Sorry, what is the vortex? Does the vortex...
The vortex core is... Oops. The vortex core is given by that black circle.
But it evolves in time. It satisfies my research.
It's a Gaussian vortex and it's very, very slowly decaying in time. Like it's becoming diffused in time, but nothing else is happening. So if the Reynolds number was small, it would diffuse out very fast. But if the Reynolds number is large, the diffusion is going to be practically absent in the time scale of this.
What is the significance of the color coding? It's sort of particles in the outer region.
Particles in the inner region, and I'm coming to that.
You have the green ones propagating outwards. Are they propagating into the red region?
Yes. Okay. They're propagating into the red region, and we will come back into that. So basically, for small, heavy inertial particles, the Maxey-Rayleigh famous equations are always used. So they're given very simply by x dot, the location goes as the velocity, and the velocity, basically the particles want to follow the flow, u is the fluid velocity, v is the particle velocity. The particles want to follow the flow, but they're reluctant to follow the flow because they have a time constant tau, which is given like this. A is the particle diameter, so you can see that the time constant scales as the square of the particle size. Nu is the kinematic viscosity and rho p by rho f is the density ratio of the particle to fluid. So if the particle is very heavy, it has a bigger time constant. And so it's trying to follow the flow with this reluctance. And it's this reluctance which gives an outward movement to the particles, the centrifugal movement to the particles. Otherwise, the particle would passively go around in a circle wherever there's a vortex. So this is basically the equations. So we'll rewrite the equations for particles near a vortex because we know U for the vortex. And so we use this special length scale where tau is the time constant of this particle, so response time of the particle, and gamma is the circulation of the vortex. So we make up a length scale made up of these two objects, one to do with the particle, the other to do with the vortex.
If your vortex is decaying, then gamma would be a time-dependent
quantity. Gamma is a time-dependent quantity. So then, but in the time scale that we are concerned with, it's so very small that we consider gamma to be a constant. So then tau also can be a time-dependent quantity if the particle is growing or shrinking. We will come to that. So then, like, the beauty is that in this length scale, you get a parameter-free set of equations for the particle dynamics. Okay, this bunch of equations is, it's just for the radius of the particle and the angular coordinate of the particle. And B of t can be taken as 1 right now. It changes when the particle grows. It's made to account for changes in tau with time.
Isn't a solid particle, the radius changes in tau?
So they need not be solid particles. They can be droplets. Okay. In fact, my talk is about droplets. So these droplets can condense, evaporate, grow, shrink, coalesce. They can do a variety of things. But if they're acting as solid particles, then the BT is just 1. Okay? So this is basically the set of equations near a vortex.
What is zeta?
Zeta is the angular coordinate.
Oh, okay, so it's polar coordinates.
Yeah, it's the angular velocity. The angular velocity will just settle to 1.
And the particles are monodispersed?
The particles here are monodispersed. But we've done simulations with several kinds of dispersion. I'm not talking about all that today, but there's lots of fun things which happen when you change the particle dispersion.
Particles have any potentials, like particle interactions or they?
Right now, nothing. Particles are non-interacting. It's a dilute suspension. It looks not dilute in the movie because we had to exaggerate the particle size, but actually it's very, very dilute. And so they don't talk to each other, and they don't affect back the flow yet. In this part, they don't affect back the flow. The thing is, this set of equations, very simple equations, have actually a boundary layer structure. If you write them out carefully, you will see that it's a singular perturbation type problem where the region very close to the vortex, and here we're calling r equal to 0 and we're going out in r. The region very close to the vortex has a different structure from the region far away from the vortex. I don't have time to go into the algebra, but it's not very complicated. So then, in this singular perturbation problem, you get a different dynamics there and a different dynamics here. The changeover occurs at a radius of order 1 in the length scale I told you, the tau gamma under root. So then this numerically can be found to be around 0.5. So in there the inner solution takes place, in here the outer solution takes place. And you can write down this del dot V, which stands for the divergence, basically the compressibility that's going on. The particles are in a compressible field. They can come closer and closer to each other or go further and further away from each other. So in the two regions, two regimes, here you have a very large and positive divergence. And that is given simply by that. And so you have particles leaving that place in no time, ballistically. So this vicinity is evacuated quickly. In the outer layer, the far away from the vortex, nothing much is happening. Particles are coming together very slowly. Remember, R is a large quantity. And del dot U is a small, del dot V is a small negative quantity. So you're getting slow compression of particles because of slow centrifuging and nothing much has happened. So this is two different regions of those red and green particles, which I would like you to remember when we come back to discuss what this is doing to other things. So the first thing we talked about is that particles leave the central region very fast, and there's a difference in that, in the dynamics of one vortex. Now let's forget for about 5 minutes on about particles.
Can I ask a question? I mean, if you did what we heard about yesterday, Descartes stopped, if you assume that you have sort of a continuous density.
Yes.
Assuming radial symmetry and everything, you should be able to write down sort of an advection diffusion equation for that.
Yes. You can write it down in most circumstances, and I will come to that. But there are circumstances where you cannot write it down. And the beauty is that the inner green particles I showed you, in that region you cannot write it down, because the particles are not in a field. They form what is called as caustics. And so particles can overtake each other, and this is a very important part of the dynamic. So you cannot assign a velocity to a place and time. So you cannot treat it as a field under any circumstances.
In Eckhart's case, the particles were passive, other than sediment. They didn't have any inertia.
Yes. Even here in the outer region, you can do that. You can do very well with an advection diffusion equation, and we will come to that. We've actually solved one such.
You mentioned that you can't always write the velocity field for the particles, but on the previous slide you had the divergence of V, but V is the velocity of the particles.
Particles, yes.
So it's not a field, right?
How yeah,
do you
so,
take the divergence?
So the point is, the place where it's not a field, we've not done anything. So, okay, technically I can always get the divergence by seeing how many particles are leaving. I may not be able to write it as a gradient operator everywhere. And in this case, what happens is, in the inside I'm able to write that, in the outside I'm able to write that, but in the regime of interaction where I showed you that the inner solution crosses over to the outer solution, there I'm not able to write it, because these caustics thing happen all the time. Okay, so let's forget about particles for a few minutes, and let's talk about vortices which are light or heavy compared to their surroundings. And we'll come down to why we are talking about it. So we have two vortices right now which we're going to discuss, and they're going to be either light or heavy. There's going to be a density difference between them and their surroundings. And so first let's consider no buoyancy. So nothing matters, like the fact that the density is different doesn't matter. On this side is vorticity, this side is density. So these two vortices are identical but of opposite sign. And we place them there, and this is the density. In this case, they are lighter than their surroundings. And I think the student has put gravity the other way, but it doesn't matter. This figure doesn't have gravity. So what happens when these two vortices just go? What would you expect, the dynamics? When there's no gravity, nothing? Just two vortices? Just walk in a straight line. Yeah, they just walk in a straight line. Now let's put buoyancy. And this is a small amount of buoyancy, mind you. Fruit number is 100. That's a large fruit number. And they will not walk in a straight line. Yeah? They did not. So now let's try another separation. Yeah?
So that buoyancy makes the walking configuration unstable somehow.
Yes.
Because you have this.
Yes.
But I wanted to say you have symmetry, but you don't really, because the vortices are opposite.
The vorticities are different. The vortices are lighter. Okay, so the dynamics, like the first time we saw this result, we knew that something simple can explain it. And we came up with this explanation. So it's like a cricket ball, right? When you suppose you're spinning it that way, and you have vorticity upstairs. So you're spinning it that way, and it's got a relative velocity that way to the fluid. So then what happens? It swings. There's a Magnus lift on it, and it will swing this way. So basically, it's exactly that. The vortex is behaving like a solid object which is swinging. So
why does the gravity make a difference?
Well, there's density stratification. So the amount of momentum that you get is different.
Above oh, right. Below.
Yeah. Without that, you cannot have that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that what you're seeing there is buoyancy acting on the pressure field of the other vortex. There is a pressure field around the vortex. The pressure is is lower near the vortex, so buoyancy will just drive you there.
So basically, this doesn't care about the other vortex. It's just the Magnus lift acting on it.
Sure.
Yeah. It's just the Magnus lift. I'll show you how. So then, like, these two vortices, even if left in isolation, would start walking this way. We've just pointed them so that they'll walk towards each other, that's all. And then, when they come very close to each other, then they see each other's pressure field, and then there is entropy creation, smaller scales, and everything else that happens.
And you mean that you have a single vortex?
Single vortex will translate, yeah. If it's light, it'll translate. Yeah, if it's light, it will translate.
So basically the same thing will happen for your vortex ring, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for a vortex ring.
That's a 2D calculation.
This is a 2D calculation. Yeah, lots of fun things will happen there. So then, let's just watch, show this in 3D just to prove that it's not a 2D effect. So we've run the whole thing in 3D. We've run a whole bunch of simulations in 3D, but I'm just showing you one particular thing. So you can evidently see that the vortices have come closer together. We're just starting to do 3D, so I don't have very large number of results to show here. So, yeah, basically they are kind of merging, these vortices. One more thing that you can notice is that the vorticity changes sign as it goes up. Remember, blue is on that side. And now, when at the end of the movie, you'll find red on that side. Yeah? So it's actually flipping. There's new vorticity created and it's flipping.
Show that again.
Yeah, so new vorticity is created. It's actually baroclinic torque that's, pulling these little vortex filaments into little rings, which are then combining to create that. Yeah? Okay, so now we write this simple equation pretending that the vortex is a cricket ball. So then we just have this Magnus lift and we have a drag force on it, which is proportional to velocity square. So then we have the vortex trajectory, which is in the dots, and the cricket ball trajectory, which is in the line, which does pretty well.
Can you say something about the total positive and negative vorticity in the system? Is that changing? You said that you're creating.
Yes.
Is it really going up?
Yeah, that is actually changing. The entropy goes up and comes down, I'll show you. So what happens is that when initially you're losing kinetic energy because you're gaining potential energy. You're actually forcing these light vortices downwards. So you're gaining in potential energy. And then like that gets released into kinetic energy, and at that time there's a lot of entropy creation. And the kinetic, it kind of breaks down into small scale structures. And this is another one when the balls didn't start perfectly next to each other. Yeah, this is the picture of entropy and so on. So then basically this dashed line is how the vorticity, the location, so initially it travels downwards and then shoots up. Then at the lowest point, there's a kind of merger of these two vortices. They effectively cancel out each other. But then it's followed by this enormous entropy creation and then an increase in kinetic energy. So the basic point is that the nature of turbulence is going to change with this. So we will watch a 2D movie of many vortices just to convince you of that. This is the usual one without gravity. And this one is with gravity. So tell me if you see any change. You see a difference? Lots of small scale structures. Yeah. So then like the picture looks this different. We've analyzed like many things like their strain contours and so many other things, which we won't go into the details. The thing is that the spectrum changes a little bit. So typically you're seeing much more small-scale structures with buoyancy than without. So the moral is that if you have vortices which are lighter, the final turbulence may be different. And so, yeah, question?
Actually, this is a very simple. I think I've lost track of where the particles were from the earlier part.
There's no particles.
Okay, the first part was about particles. The first part was about particles. We threw it away. Now no particles, like vortices. And now we're going to see them coming together. We're going to see like how they come together. Okay, so that comes together in droplets with phase change. Yes.
I have a very silly question. So
there's no silly question.
In the two vortex video you showed, is the net circulation constant?
The net circulation does not remain constant because there's light vorticities, right? So you can actually create vorticity by baroclinic torque.
Okay.
So like. So you can imagine, like, if there's a light fluid sitting on top of heavy fluid, and suppose you tilt the surface, it's going to do that. So baroclinic torque is created. So if you write down the vorticity equation with gravity in place,
because of gravity,
you will see that there is a baroclinic torque term.
Without gravity,
there's no change in vorticity. The vorticity can only die, like it can only dissipate. Okay, so not everything I say has to do with clouds, but the motivation is clouds. So let me just give a brief thing. So in a cloud, there are large-scale fields such as vorticity and temperature. They push around these droplets and things, and the droplets undergo phase change whenever they are in a supersaturated or subsaturated environment. So droplets can grow, decay. They can also coalesce, collide, do all this. Every phase change event really results in latent heat creation or destruction. So then this latent heat gives additional buoyancy to the cloud, and then that buoyancy affects the large scale. So we're going to see a toy thing, which in the end I'll come back to cloud and say, does it have anything to do with cloud or not? But right now we will talk about the things we talked about with this background in mind. So you have droplets which can undergo phase change, and they are going to create buoyancy. So now the basic connection I was trying to draw is that if the central part is emptied of droplets, and this is the summary of my talk which I'd like to convince you at the end, the central part near every vortex is emptied of droplets very quickly, then phase change will occur outside. You need droplets in a supersaturated environment to grow. If there are no droplets or no particles, there's nothing which can grow. So then, like, you will have all phase change events outside. So the vortex will become lighter or heavier than its surroundings without you doing anything. And then that will give rise to new dynamics. And that's the central message. Okay. So let's look at the equations we solved. It's a royal mess, but it's actually not as bad as it looks. So this is the vorticity equation. We're solving it in 2D for now. And then the temperature equation with the Heaviside step function for latent heat. So this term will get switched on every time you are in a supersaturated environment. And then this vapor term, vapor has a similar equation. Liquid. So this is what Bruno had asked in the beginning. Can I write a dynamical equation for it? We can write a dynamical equation by making this approximation. Actually, this should be an approximate sign. The Maxey-Rayleigh equation can be expanded like this to first order in the Stokes number of the particle. And so if you make this approximation, you can treat it as a field and you can write this equation. And here the liquid diffusivity we've taken to be zero, and all other diffusivities are equal. And so this is the set of equations we're solving. With the help of this, we've written this. And so you'll see that the d by dt operator becomes different now because of the way we've written it. Otherwise, everything else remains the same for that equation as well. There are five non-dimensional parameters here. The Reynolds number, Froude number, and this is a latent heat parameter. We use values for all of these which are, you know, reasonable for cloud things. And then there's a particle Stokes number, which is a non-dimensional version of the particle response time that we talked about a while ago. And then comes a new Stokes number, which comes because of the phase change. Yes.
How do you determine the saturation threshold?
The saturation threshold. So we basically prescribe a value for this. So we say the temperature is this much, and the background temperature is this much, and therefore there's a saturation vapor pressure. So basically, Clausius Clapeyron. So we prescribe it using Clausius Clapeyron. And then, so these are the five parameters. We already discussed what happens with Froude number, and the Reynolds number is unimportant if it's reasonably high. So the main parameters we want to talk about are these two Stokes numbers, the particle Stokes number and the phase change Stokes number. So there's two time scales at which this is happening. So what we want is basically that the center should empty out very quickly of every vortex, and condensation should happen after that. So in the time in which condensation is going to happen, you have to empty it out to as great a distance as you can. And if you do that, you get an effective Atwood number, namely an effective lightness or heaviness inside the vortex. And that, with a few, you know, lines of algebra, you can say should scale as the product of these two Stokes numbers to the square root. And this is the best density difference that you can achieve. So this, and we're going to now check in our simulations whether we can get something like this. So basically, we would like to see this in our simulations. Okay, so the simulations start here. We first repeat the exercise with the two vortices because we know what they did when we made them light. And so can we achieve that by this kind of phase change? So remember, now we've got a flow with droplets sprinkled all over, two vortices sitting there, and nothing else. We have a temperature, and we're going to allow these droplets to condense or evaporate. We start out with everything being supersaturated by 2%. So then, like, they want to condense. The droplets want to grow bigger. So this is the scenario we are starting with. There's no density difference, nothing else that we started out with. And so at time equal to zero, the temperature, this temperature perturbation theta was zero everywhere. And this rho vapor was 1.04 everywhere. Sorry, this is 4% supersaturation. So this is 1.04 everywhere at time equal to zero. At time equal to five, what's happened is the following. The vapor concentration has come down. Except where the vortices were, it's come down less. So that means that there's some condensation activity. So the vapor has gone into liquid form. And corresponding to that, you have a temperature rise over here. So as time proceeds, you will see that within the vortex, the activity is very low. Everywhere outside, the activity is high. So in other words, condensation events are happening outside and this is going on. So then, like, without giving any initial density difference, we get our vortex trajectories to do this. The vortices are going there, and then there's an annihilation and a dipole is created. So there's a linear fall in the separation of the two vortices. So initially nothing happened for a short time. You can see that the separation, they tried to go down for a short time, but they couldn't, because very soon their density changed by a very, very small amount. The density has changed by a very small amount, way less than 1%. And still there's a linear fall in the separation. And then, as we saw before, the vorticity switches sides. There is always entropy creation, and then it goes towards a kinetic energy minimum. And because the density difference earlier we put in was slightly larger, this one is way less than 1%, the whole process is slower by a factor of about 10. So then at the end of our simulation, we've only come to the region where the kinetic energy has decreased a lot. It's correspondingly, the potential energy has increased a lot. So then here is the one without inertia, particles without inertia. And here is the particle, is the simulation for particles with inertia. So you need these inertial particles who cleared out the region of the vortex in a time scale before which the condensation could occur. And then, sorry?
finished, and then I'd like to see the previous transparency.
So basically, there's three time scales which we estimated for everything to do with the cloud, except that we put a much stronger vortex than the prescribed scale would give by Kolmogorov. So what we saw is that particles will leave the vicinity of the vortex, in of this very strong vortex, in the order of fractions of a second. And these are 10 micron droplets, water droplets, which are typical of a cloud. They will leave in fractions of a second. The condensation will take 10 seconds of that order to take place. And then the you know, now that the condensation has taken place and the density difference is created, the rest of the dynamics takes many, much, much longer than this. But it's well within a cloud time scale. So for this to happen, the cloud vortex should be very intermittent. So only in very intermittent vortices within a cloud, this kind of thing will happen. But there must be like lots of industrial flows, ocean sprays, and many situations where this thing should be far, far more noticeable. But in a cloud, one would have to go looking for it in the vicinity of the strong vortices. But in a cloud, we want, you know, like, some mechanism for large drops to get created, and even if it's a rare occurrence, it can actually be pretty significant. So that's my point. Sorry, Greg.
Oh, no, I think you've answered it, actually. So the point is that the latent heat, the buoyancy generated by the latent heat hasn't had time to act on the scale in which these vortices come together. Is that right?
It's already finished acting.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
It's already finished acting. It takes of the order of 10 seconds. So depending on the two Stokes numbers, it can either act or not act. So there can be scenarios where the process of these particles leaving the vicinity of the vortex is so very slow, or the buoyancy, for the latent heat to take place, it's so very slow that nothing will happen. Or it could be too fast. If either of these is too fast also, nothing will happen. So then we'll come to that. So let's now watch this movie. Basically, you'll see this is vorticity, this is temperature, which is 0 at time equal to 0. This is vapor, and this is liquid. So it happens too quickly, so like just watch it. Yeah. So basically the point is that wherever the vortices are, you get colder air. Elsewhere it's warmer. And everything else follows from there. So we didn't create colder air where the vortices were, it became colder. And we said that the effective Atwood number should scale as the square root of product of the square roots of the two Stokes numbers. And we've done simulations with all of these Stokes numbers of the particle and the phase change. And you see that there is no vortex collapse here, it's business as usual. And there is vortex collapse there. And this is exactly the square root into square root, that line. So basically, when that quantity goes above 60, you get vortex collapse. So there's a region of time scales for particle and condensation where you're going to get vortex collapse. And it's exactly according to the simple-minded algebra that we had done. And the spectra now, these are the spectra where we have phase change. We did not start with light vortices. We solved all those messy equations that I showed you. And this is the no inertia spectrum, and this is the with inertia spectrum. Again, you can see that, you know, small scale structures are created to quite a degree. I wanted to talk about caustics, but I'm running out of time. Shall I skip that?
Go ahead.
Cool.
As you noticed with the first talk, I mean, we say 45 and we run for 60 minutes, so you have another 20 minutes.
Oh, great. Okay. Okay. So,
including discussions, yeah.
Hmm?
Including discussion.
Including discussion. No, I'll finish fast. I won't say everything about caustics that I want to. So then we talked about this. We'll talk about what caustics are. I didn't write it in great detail because I thought I would never get to it. So then there is clustering, collisions, and coalescence. So we know that to make droplets bigger very, very fast, we know that simple diffusion of one droplet walking through space is not going to do the trick. You are going to need droplets to coalesce, and that is going to increase the size distribution very, very quickly. So you need coalescence to effectively, for raindrops, everybody knows that turbulence, you know, causes these droplets to come together, cluster in these non-vertical regions, and that can become important for the frequency of collisions and therefore of coalescence. So the one mechanism I want to talk about for in this context is caustics. And the caustics that I'm going to talk about are not the usual ones that are talked about in literature. Like whenever people say caustics, they mean a place where particles are not describable by a field. Their dynamics is not describable by a field. They're coming from two different places and dashing against each other. This is basically what everybody means. We mean the same thing, but we don't want these particles to come, you know, ballistically out of two regions and dash against each other. We're talking about particles which are coming out of the same vortex. And we're saying that they're coming out of the same vortex, except that the one at the rear is catching up with the one in front. And whenever it catches up with the one in front, it can coalesce. So this is the mechanism of single sling caustics that we would like to consider. And we are asking, did I forget the movie? No, I didn't. I should show the movie first. So we are asking, what difference does it make? So let's come back to our old story about the boundary layer. We had this inner boundary layer near a vortex, where we had ballistic motion of particles, and we had this outer region where the particles were, you know, in this slow motion. We found out that by simulations that this ring is 0.5, of size 0.5 in that non-dimensional, this quantity. And in this case we put this 0.3 is of another scale, sorry, there's a factor of 2 pi or something, sorry. So then this thing is the vortex in this case. We put these particles up to that critical radius. Everybody in the green can overtake somebody. Everybody in the red can never overtake somebody. They can only come closer and closer to each other, and they will never walk past anybody. So then we'll see if walking past somebody is important to become a big droplet or not. So what we'll do is, whenever two droplets come together, with some probability, we basically gone by some literature of, you know, approach velocities and this and that, and we've made an empirical probability for them to coalesce or to bounce off. So with some probability, they'll become a bigger drop when they touch each other. So these guys are also allowed to touch each other, remember. But they're not allowed to walk past each other, or they do not walk past each other. We will ask how, and then what we're going to do is, we're going to color the drops blue if a green collides with a green, or a green coalesces with a red. When a green guy is in the equation, in this coalescence thing, we'll color that droplet black or blue, and we'll continue that color forever, evermore. So if a guy who originated as green has taken part in the collision, we will color him black or blue, and let's see who participates most in making the big drops. And remember, as the drops come bigger and become bigger and bigger, they fly out more and more. Their caustics region becomes bigger and bigger, so they're more and more ballistic. And this is a simulation with identical particles. It becomes way, way more dramatic if you even change the particle sizes by 10 or 20%. So then we've done simulations with that as well. Oh, sorry, this one is with a slight distribution in particle size, this particular simulation. So it's actually already the dramatic one. So the red guy who coalesces with another red guy remains red.
How many collisions is a typical blue one? Is that a product of one coalescence of two drops, or are there multiple coalescences getting bigger and bigger?
Yeah, so after one coalescence, we color it blue. Mm-hmm. And then the size of the thing indicates like how big it has become. So then the thing is, all of these are typically with multiple collisions. And you can show by a simple bunch of algebra that once you've had a collision, you're way more likely to have further and further collisions because your caustics radius increases. Your caustics radius goes as square root of your tau, and your tau goes as square of your radius. So once you've done this, you can keep having multiple collisions. So the guys who are likely to have collisions are those who are already bigger than the others.
And is it a totally straightforward calculation where you're just determining particle trajectory? You've got a big array of particles and their positions, and you're doing an n squared calculation of, yeah.
Yeah, that's all we're doing. We do, each particle is an individual who's doing his or her own thing, and they're all like randomly distributed at time equal to zero. And we've repeated it for many different conditions, many different such things.
Sorry, you probably answered this many times, but how do you define quadrescence here?
Okay, so when I did not define it. So when two particles come next to each other, such that their radial separation, their separation of the centers is less than the sum of their radii.
So there's no minimization of the energy or anything, it's just mechanically.
So when they come within this, then we ask the question, and then we have a formula which says if they came together too fast, they're likely to bounce or things like that. We plug in this empirical formula, and then with some probability, they become one droplet instantaneously, and with some probability, they bounce off with their incoming thing. They bounce off elastically. So this is basically what we've given to them. So like this... Remember that I said these vortices are very, very strong and are going to occur only rarely in a cloud, but they can occur in many situations. In clouds, these can form seeds because you need some big seeds. So even in clouds, we think they could have some role, and it will be nice if people can find it out with big simulations if this is true or false.
So you used realistic parameters in these simulations, right? You sort of ballpark realistic parameters,
yeah.
Physical parameters. How about the results of the size of the droplets that result from this? Are those big enough, like those raindrops?
Yeah. So we couldn't continue the simulation enough to make it, raindrop size. But this part agreed very well with our theory. We wrote down a theory for the number of collisions, and this part agreed with our theory, and we could extrapolate the theory for a very, very large number of collisions. And yes, like within reasonable time, like a few minutes, we could have raindrops. But everything else is actual values which are good for a cloud, except the strength of the vortex, which is very strong. So like you need an intermittent vortex to create this. You cannot have the usual Kolmogorov vortex which will create this. So at all length scales, if we can have these spectacularly strong vortices, let's say 5 times stronger than the average vortex, 5 to 10 times, which is not unreasonable. You do get vorticities like that which last forever. Actually, those stringy structures, filamenty structures are actually strong and long-lived. So it's not that they never occur, but they're not as common as a Kolmogorov, what you get from Kolmogorov scaling. So this is the answer. So I think, this is just a plot showing how much the density peaks in that caustics region. And this is a thing showing how basically, we've started particles sitting outside the caustics region and within the caustics region. And in both cases, you'll see that the people who started either on the edge of the caustics or within the caustics are the most likely to go into high density regions. The color here shows the density, number density of particles, which we've obtained by a different method, which I won't go into. It's just the number of particles we have is not good enough to give us a good color for this. And that's about all I wanted to say on caustics. I'll stop here.
I mean, you're basically doing these things with point vortices, or vortices which are very small.
Lambertian vortices, which are very small.
How important is that? Because your caustics, for example, they seem to be far from the vortex. So So they shouldn't care too much whether the vortex is very strong, or they would just want some circulation within that region. And it wouldn't really matter whether it's a fractal vortex or a, you know, something distorted.
Yeah, so the exact shape of the vortex doesn't matter. And we've actually used finite thickness, like they're reasonably large core, they're not that small core. And the point is that this situation is going, you're saying that, I mean, if I'm a particle, I'm far away from all the vortices, so what do I care? The point is that the small Stokes number particles take quite a long time to leave the vicinity of one vortex. So for the very, very large Stokes number, it's quite right. It's ballistically coming from different vorticities. But in clouds and in many situations, the initial particle distribution is so small that they cannot leave the vicinity of a vortex so easily. They act closer to passive particles, so going round and round and round in spirals which are slowly widening. And this is for that. In my simulations, the angular velocity is way, way, way bigger than the radial velocity.
I mean, that's only for the very initial part. Just to empty your vortex. After that, it shouldn't matter much.
After that, it shouldn't matter. It is only for the emptying part. And that's the mechanism that we're talking about. After that, it doesn't care about where it came from. But already, if it's a bigger drop, it can become even bigger, and various other things can happen.
Can you say something about the initial droplet size and the initial number density around your vortex?
Okay. So those we tried to obey cloud numbers. So we tried to take in dimensional sense, something like 10 to the power of 8 droplets per meter cube and 10 micron droplets. So this is what we took.
I'm still fascinated with this gravity.
Thank you.
If you had a co-rotating works, if they go around, right?
Yeah,
if you
yeah.
have no viscosity. Have you tried to see what happens if you have gravity?
Yeah, so what happens in a co-rotating system is that both of them get pushed the same way because the Magnus effect gives them the same thing. So they do this, and they go off there. Yeah. And then they have, you know, combine in a very spirally way. Yeah.
Can you put up that movie again?
Which one?
The one
so we all like.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. The one about the vortices and the buoyancy.
Okay.
From number around 100 or somewhere.
So no. Yeah.
This one?
Yeah. Any one of them will do. The question I'd like to ask in this context, so if you start this, very nice, they go together and then the vorticity turns around. Now, if your initial condition had perfect mirror symmetry,
yes,
that could not happen, right?
As in perfect mirror symmetry, you mean the vortices of the same size?
I mean, the initial conditions is that you have your two localized vortices of opposite sides, and then they're sort of going together, turning around, and jumping back up.
Yeah.
But if your initial condition is sort of perfectly symmetric.
Oh, you're saying mirror symmetry about this axis?
About this axis.
About this axis. It is mirror symmetric, right? Except they're opposite signed.
Okay.
Can you show us the trajectory? You showed us trajectories. You actually showed the particle, the vortex core trajectories.
Yeah.
Could you show us that?
Vortex core trajectories, okay.
Can you post a little bit later?
Now let's just see how they cross.
Yeah. So this part,
it looks pretty symmetric there.
How did
they
pass
through?
But actually what happens,
no,
the point is that I had a slow motion movie which I couldn't find this morning.
Okay.
So the slow motion movie explains it nicely, but I'll tell it in words. So what happens is they come here, and then as they reach this place, they actually annihilate each other. Because there's a negative and a positive vorticity coming towards each other. And while they're annihilating each other, there is this filamentary debris which is created, which tends to be of opposite sign because you can work that out from the baroclinic talk. And that filamentary debris kind of coalesces into these blobby things. And the debris is of opposite sign. So I wouldn't take this part of the matching too seriously.
The part that I
should actually stop the matching here.
No, the part that is important about this then is that I was sort of thinking about what point vortices would do. And with point vortices, you can get that because, I mean, they could not change identity or something.
Right.
So what you have is you need these things to be extended and they get very close together.
And you need viscosity to, you know, rub them out and to do all this.
Yeah, and then they sort of separate. There's an interior part that emulates and then the outer part sort of goes off.
Yeah.
Very nice. I wish you'd had that movie.
The slow-mo one?
That's very fascinating. It has to be some finite size effect.
For some bizarre reason, I couldn't find it this morning.
You discovered this by luck?
We wanted to do these light vortices, and the rest of it was luck. We wanted to do light vortices because we realized that temperature differences are going to create light and heavy vortices in a cloud. So that was a thought experiment.
Can someone do the real experiment of these?
That will be amazing if someone can. And we always like to, go to the simplest one, like one vortex, two vortex, things where we can think. So, yeah.
And the point is about this, Mr. Chairman, is what it has to add on top to it.
Have you done a ring? So you can. Seems like it's easier to make a ring vortex than two point vortices.
But
so you have the axisymmetric analog of this drawing.
Of this,
Now the ring sort of collapses on itself and should do something interesting.
Exactly, and the Kelvin, but the Kelvin theorem will make them thicker as they come together, so it should happen a lot faster. So it should be interesting to see in a ring, and that might be even better in an experiment.
So it might be easier to generate.
I should watch Shmuel Rubinstein's talk at the conference, which he did experiments of two colliding vortex rings.
Not in a stratified fluid. Yeah.
Okay, but it'll be nice to induce him to do this.
Exactly.
Very good. Any more questions?
Yeah, I guess maybe about your droplet thing. What is the prospect? I guess what you're doing with this empirical goal here is to go from empirical models of droplet formation in clouds in federal or unscaled all this stuff. What are the prospects of the work that you've done? Like, how far along are you?
So right now I can't give an honest answer to that because the thing is that we've used vortices which are stronger than you normally see in a cloud. So unless like people see this, unless people focus on those strong vortices and see if this is indeed happening, and then, you know, in their code, like check for coalescence and all that, we hope it's going to matter. That's basically what I can say. Because like from all the papers on droplet growth, you see that you don't need a large number of big droplets. You need just a few big droplets and who can actually generate raindrop formation quite well. So every billionth drop, if it's big, that's enough. It's like that. The ratio is that much. So that's why we are hopeful, but I don't know the answer.
So with that, thank you very much.